has been an experiment with time on WRCT Pittsburgh. If you've been digging the music you heard here tonight, check out the full playlist up on WRCT.org and have a great night, folks. Take care of yourselves.
This is Shannon Lee Reynolds. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Trump is a morbid symptom. The real issue is the economic and political system of this country, and that's called capitalism. This is an issue of reorganizing society. Because right now, in this shift that is happening, where the world, that world that we knew is dying, and the new world is attempting to be born, is struggling to be born. We need midwives to foster, to nurture, to bring that new world into existence.
That's Claudia de la Cruz, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Claudia de la Cruz, Imagining a New World. Authoritarianism can't happen here, you say. Look around. Open your eyes. No one is safe. Dissent is being criminalized. People are being arrested without due process. When Trump was asked if it is his job to uphold the Constitution, he said, "I don't know." Claudia de la Cruz says, Trump and his cabinet full of billionaires are waging an all-out war on our communities, from slashing thousands of jobs to massively defunding critical programs that many working-class people rely on to survive. At this critical moment, she says, we can't simply lay down and allow his administration to roll back all the rights that our people's movements have won. Now is the time to organize our communities and stand up to fight back, unquote. In these dark times, we cannot be bystanders. We must resist and imagine and create a new world where peace, equality, dignity, and justice are the norm. Our guest today is Claudia de la Cruz. She's an educator and community organizer. For nearly 30 years, she's worked on building people power locally, nationally, and internationally. In 2024, she ran for President of the United States, representing the Party of Socialism and Liberation. She's the Executive Director of IFCO, the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organization. She spoke in May 2025 in Boulder, as part of her Fighting the Billionaire Coup, We Won't Back Down tour. And now, Claudia de la Cruz.
We are experiencing an unprecedented time, right? And I would dare say that most of us who are above the age of 40 have probably not seen a moment like this before. And it's important to say that and call it, because the fact that we are living these unprecedented times, which are historical times of repression, historical times of oppression, also call for historical times of resistance. They call for historical times of creativity and utilizing everything and anything we know to be able to fight back, and not only fight for our future, but fight for our now, because things are happening very rapidly. I think it's important for us to let our people know that we cannot be bystanders. We can't afford to be bystanders. We cannot afford to be apathetic. We cannot afford to become cynicist. We cannot afford to lose hope, because any single right that we lose at this moment, we will not get tomorrow. What we are experiencing is something that Gramsci spoke about. I am a true fan of Gramsci. Antonio Gramsci was an Italian communist. He was a theorist, but he's also a prisoner. He was a political prisoner. They imprisoned him in a moment of fascism, a moment in which people voted in fascism. A lot of the peasantry, a lot of working class people voted in fascism. And his deep question was, why do people act against their interest? Why is it that working class people act against their interest and advance the interests of those who are our class enemies? He asked himself, why is it so hard to build an alliance and a relationship between those who are organizing rural areas and those who are organizing in the urban setting? He asked many questions. And there was something very key, or at least to me, that I appreciate from his writing, and is the key role of cultural conditioning and how cultural conditioning is connected to the economic base, meaning the economy that runs society. And that's how we understand a lot of things. In his analysis, he said something that I think is very relevant to today. He said, the old world is dying and the new world is struggling to be born. And in the interim, morbid symptoms will arise. We need to think of Trump as a morbid symptom. And I'm being very serious about that. And why do I say we need to think of Trump as a morbid symptom? Because he is not the illness. The illness is the economic and political system that we know as capitalism. An economic system that has failed not only the people in this country, but people across the globe. In this world that is dying, we need to acknowledge that there has been many moments in history in which capitalism has been in crises. And in every one of those moments, there has been an attempt from the ruling class, from the capitalists, to save capitalism. We need to ask ourselves, why Trump and why now? I know a lot of people, I know I do it all the time. When I hear that man speak, I clown him because there's nothing else to do, right? Like, I clown him. I say, this is disturbing, but like, this is almost like comedic. This is, you know, and there's so many ways of characterizing it in a way that we could potentially dismiss just how threatening he is, not only to us, but to the world. And again, he's a symptom. He is something that the capitalist system, the economic system in which we live, has birthed. So the narrative that white poor people are the reason he's there is a lie. The narrative that it was Black and Latino voters that voted him in is a lie. Let's talk about the democratic process in this country. The Electoral College is who decides who the president is going to be. So let's start there. This is not one person, one vote. Okay? We live in a society where democracy is good for those who have money. It's a dollar democracy. It's not a democracy of the people. Therefore, the people, the working class people of this country, are not to be blamed by the morbid symptom that is Trump. Trump is a result, again, of a system that is a failed system and that has both Democrats and Republicans to blame. The Democratic Party has been in office for many times in the last 30 years. People talk about Project 2025 as it was something that was born last year during the campaign trail. And that's a lie. Project 2025, if you pick it up and you read it, is something that has been in development since the 1980s, since Reagan. A lot of presidents and administrations have come in and out, Democrats too. And so they are also complicit in our having to deal with their problem, which is Trump. And so we need to be really clear that the conditions have been created to birth someone like Trump to become the president of the United States and engage in the billionaire coup that he's engaging in now, which is an overt, a very open war against working class people. That is what we are experiencing. He has been really clear about what their agenda is, but he is doing it in a way that is shock and awe. He's doing it rapidly, forcefully, to confuse, to isolate, to demoralize, to disintegrate any possibility for us of thinking that there could be another way. This is creating a deeper crisis in every human being in the United States. People are feeling scared. People are feeling, again, like this is the end of the world. And we need to remember that capitalists thrive on that. The economic system, those billionaires that want to keep us down, thrive on chaos so that we don't have an opportunity to think clearly or even attempt coming together, because every sector of the working class is being hit. So everyone is concerned about how they're being hit. And we need to keep in mind that symptoms are momentary. If you have an illness, you experience the symptom, and they might come back again and again and again and again if you don't treat it at the root. So this problem is not about changing who's going to oppress us next. It's not about Democrats or Republicans. This is about the deep issue of capitalism in this country, and I want us to get it. Dealing with an economic system that is a failed system, that is of the old world. What do I mean of the old world? This is going to sound like a history lesson, and some of you may know this, and if I am wrong, you can fact check me, because I like fact checks. So post-World War II, 1945, the United States presents itself internationally as the soft power, in quotation marks, because they were still doing a lot of aggressive, violent ways and things to be able to dominate. A lot of dictatorships, for example, that the United States was backing, supporting, that gave birth to oligarchs in this continent. One example was 1954 in Guatemala. You know, you place a dictator, you make the dictator your friend, you fund the dictator and whatever it is that they do, torturing people, disappearing people, destroying any type of opponent. And then you build a class within that country that is going to become your junior partner and that's going to allow you to utilize, extract, you know, labor, resources, you name it. And that model expanded. It went from Guatemala to Chile, to where I'm from, the Dominican Republic, to Cuba, to Venezuela. I mean, if you look at the CIA's greatest hits, every country that you could potentially think of has been intervened by the United States somehow, either politically, economically, or militarily. And so they became, utilizing those methods, the hegemon of the world, economically, politically, and militarily. They created NATO as an alliance to sell, in some ways, security to oligarchs from European countries, telling them we will be your partners and we will keep you safe from those communists. And so NATO was created. The IMF was created and the World Bank was created as a way of making the global South into a sweatshop and nations that would become slaved by debt to the United States. Are you following me? Even when we talk about the question of Palestine, there is a formation in 1948 of what we know now as a colonial state of Israel. And Israel's role in the Middle East has been and will be to do exactly what NATO has done in Europe, what AFRICOM has done in Africa, what the Southern Command has done in these territories. And so there was the establishment of a military force, of an economic force, of a political force through the UN. Everyone has a vote, but who has the right to veto? Dominance in all sorts of ways. Now the world is shifting. We are in a new stage where there are new economies that are arising. Economies that are becoming powerful and are building relationships with other nations in another way in the global South. Now you see China building relationships with other countries in Asia, with countries in the Americas, with countries in Europe. India is growing economically too. Russia is growing economically too. Brazil is growing economically too. The concept and model of a dependency model is becoming obsolete. Nation states are actually building themselves. The world is shifting. And the United States is being left behind. And so if economically, if politically, you are being isolated as the United States hegemon of the world, as the big superpower, the best person for the job is Trump. Because he will be forceful, because he will be a bully, because he will do things that people will consider to be erratic and chaotic and nonsensical. And he is okay going down in history with all those titles if it means saving capitalism. Are you following me? This is critical for us to understand. Because the more we engage in a process of clowning him without being critical about what's actually happening, we are devaluing what this shift means to us and the world. Trump is attempting to save U.S. imperialism internationally by suffocating economies, by bending the will of other nations to his will, to his interests, which are the interests of the billionaire class of the United States. But he does not understand that these nations have experienced capitalism and neoliberalism and U.S. imperialism enough to know that that's not the route. To know that there is a possibility of a multipolar world. And that is a proposal from the Global South. The Global South no longer wants to be the sweatshop of the United States. The Global South no longer wants to be the slaves via debt. The Global South wants a dignified life. And so they're aligning themselves. What's happening in Burkina Faso and the Sahel region? Saying, well, we're going to negotiate, but we're going to negotiate from a place of dignity because our people deserve dignity. Our people deserve to live and thrive. And so we're going to come from a place that has a backbone. That is something admirable and something that the United States as an imperialist force did not expect and does not like. Because every time there has been resistance that has been birthed anywhere in the world, the United States has attempted or has toppled it. And that's the only way that we can actually make reasoning of the amount of immigrants that have come into this country. Because they come here following the traces of the things that have been stolen from them. They don't come here because they one day woke up and scrubbed their belly and said, I want to cross borders. That's not how it works. And a lot of the immigrant families that come into this country come into this country with the idea of working, building some sort of wealth, and going back to their homeland. But the United States, through imperialism, does not make that viable. And we need to be really clear about that. That relationship that was one of violence, of brutality, of extraction, is coming to an end across the globe. And people are willing to sacrifice. When China says to the United States, we're okay with your tariffs. That's okay. And unless you cut the tariff game and treat us with respect and speak with us as if we are people of dignity, we are not willing to go to the negotiating table with you. That's dignity. That is dignity. That's nothing more than that. But the United States government, not the people, the government administrations of the United States do not understand dignity because they thrive on crushing the dignity of people. Trump is the person for the job in this time. He's not the ideologue. He is not the intellect. He's not the person crafting the plan. Believe me, you, he is not. But he will deliver the performance because that is Trump. I don't know how many of you used to watch WWE. I never did. My mom didn't allow that. But he is in the WWE Hall of Fame. He is a performer. I'm from New York. We know it. So I think it's very important for us to, again, know who we're dealing with and what he is capable of, because he truly, really wants to go down in history as a king. And he's utilized bending the knee so much that I lost count. And the way for him to bend people's knee to him and his administration of billionaires is through force. How does that shift from the old world to the new world look in the United States? It looks like shifting the way of governance. It's doing away with everything and anything that the people have won historically in this country. Not that the Democrats have handed to us. What people have won. We have won. Our movements have won that. We've made demands. We've forced the hand of those in political power to do what they need to do to recognize us as human beings. They haven't just benevolently handed to us those rights. And so it's important to remember that as well. Everything that we have achieved historically as a people, he's chipping away. And he's testing the waters. And the reason that I'm saying he's testing the waters is because he will go as far as we allow him to. We have to recognize our power. He will go as far as he is allowed to go. Because everything that he is doing is unconstitutional. Everything that he is doing is outside the law. These immigration raids without any type of due process, these deportations, that's illegal. He can't do that. And what he is doing also is letting us know that if you oppose, striking through fear, right? If you oppose, you'll go to jail. That judge. She had nothing to do with that person walking out of court. This person went through their proceeding and this person was granted freedom and the person left. And then she was held in contempt because the person walked out and ICE couldn't get him. And so it is, again, we need to make sense of this in this way. They are giving us alarms. They are giving us ways in which we could understand that if you oppose, they will repress. Or how do we understand the encampments and the persecution of students that have legal status? Mahmoud Khalil had a green card. He's married to a U.S. citizen. He wasn't doing anything. And undercover ICE agents came and abducted him. And he is one of many. They're breaking into houses of students that are U.S. citizens even and taking away computers and taking away phones. This is letting us know that no one is safe. And if we allow him to create categories of people that are worth saving and those that are not saving, that means that we are normalizing a terrorist governance over us. That is what's happening. And we need to be really clear about that. Bubbles burst. The middle class is almost non-existent in this country. People that are holding on to the idea, well, I'm not being bothered and I am assured of a home and I am assured of, you know, paycheck and I have my retirement plan. All good. Well, let me tell you, baby, it is estimated that almost 300,000 federal workers are going to be laid off. There are people in this town that are expected to be laid off next week. And that is happening all across. So we need to be really clear that these bubbles of so-called safety that we thought we had, we don't have. And we don't have it as working class people because we don't have control of the economy. We don't have control of the political system in this country. Again, the democracy we know is a democracy that is a dollar democracy. So we cannot just simply protect the civil rights that we have. We need to work towards building an actual popular democracy in this country. We need to work towards building economic democracy in this country, where workers who produce all the wealth have a level of control in deciding how that wealth is going to be utilized. How is it that we have someone like Elon Musk, who was not elected, running Doge or running anything in this country? Access, complete access to the Oval Office. Parading himself as if he is the president of the United States. That is crazy. And they're attempting to normalize that. And let me remind you, they're not the majority. They're building an echo chamber of a small group of people. I mean, I don't know if you all saw what happened in the newsroom, where they basically outed everyone they consider to be liberal or progressive out of the press room. And everyone that was sitting there commemorating the 100 days was right wing. And they were praising how beautiful the press secretary was and how eloquent she is. We all have different opinions, and that's okay. And, you know, how great it is to go into the White House and see all the children of all the young people that are now working there, who are deciding the lives of millions of people, kids, who also invest in the companies that they're deregulizing. It's crazy, but it's happening. And they will go as far as we allow them to go, because ultimately, we as workers have a power that we have yet to tap into. We have yet to tap into that power. I want to remind us of history. In the 1920s, during the Red Scare, there was a lot of work that was being done that actually kind of sipped itself to the Great Depression, the times of the Great Depression, that forced the hand of Roosevelt to put forth the New Deal. People always talk about him as his great president, but he wasn't as great as we think. He was a capitalist trying to save capitalism and save it from potential revolt from the people. People were organizing around labor. People were organizing around unemployment. There were unions of people who were unemployed. There were people who were organizing around tenant rights. And in all these organizing processes during the decades of the 20s and 30s, there were communists who were organizing. That's why they hit the communists so hard, because that was a potential opposition to the capitalist class. And if Roosevelt wouldn't have done that, capitalism wouldn't have been saved, because people were that tired of not having access to the most basic things. We should really study that moment in history. There's a lot of parallels. We need to think about the civil rights movement, the sit-ins, the freedom rides. A lot of people lost their lives. A lot of people lost their jobs. A lot of people were jailed. A lot of people were hosed down. It took sacrifice. But it was because of mass movement that Jim Crow was defeated. They didn't give us that. They didn't give us the Civil Rights Act. People fought for that. The same thing happened during the Vietnam War. I went to Columbia University. I saw those gates. And those gates, to me, were a reminder of the young people of 1968 that did the encampments. And the reason they put those gates up were to separate community from the student body, so that the student body didn't have to be in conversation or in exchange with the community that Columbia displaced. And so we need to be conscious that we have a legacy and a history of people who have fought back every time these capitalists have attempted to save capitalism. Every time there's a crisis, there's a war. Every time. And we need to ask ourselves why. War is profitable. Very profitable. Not for the people. It's miserable for the people in the United States and for the people across the seas. Miserable, violent, brutal. And just because we don't see actual bombs exploding here, they actually do. Because every dollar that is put in the hands of those who are waging war against Palestinian babies, against people in Sudan, against people in Haiti, against people anywhere around the world, are dollars that are being taken away from infrastructure, from jobs, from our possibility of having free education, from having affordable housing.
You're listening to Claudia de la Cruz, Imagining a New World. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977 or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
I was asking, how do people get around here? Like, is there like a bus, a train? Zero infrastructure. In terms of transportation? Like, and this is not only in Colorado. This is all across the country. All across the country, there's a zero way of planning for workers. There's all sorts of planning for capitalists, but not for workers. And that is also a result of war. When you give trillions of dollars to the Pentagon and you want to slash public education, you want to destroy the federal, like the Department of Education, you want to destroy that, but you're giving $1 trillion to the Pentagon, you're waging war not only in countries abroad, you're also waging war on students here. You're waging war on teachers. You're waging war on communities. And we need to see those as bombs. Those are bombs dropping. They want to slash Social Security. Everybody should be concerned with Social Security. Because Social Security was also was a result of movement. What was there before Social Security? We should look into that. Elders who were dying because they didn't have access to food. They weren't able to have proper housing. And I don't know about you, I plan to get old. I want to get old. And I want to make sure that what I've contributed to this society also is there to be contributed to my last days on this earth. That's what Social Security is. And now they want to privatize Social Security? I mean, we can't stand here and glorify and say Social Security is the best thing on earth. It's not. And it's not because the capitalist system doesn't allow it to be. Because if we really cared about the elderly, if we really cared about the youth, if we really cared about the children in this country, then we would invest in those children. We would invest in those youth. We would invest in actually prolonging the life of elders, giving quality life. And that's not what we do as a country. And so rather than privatizing it and having Wall Street bankers benefit from the work that our elders have put into this country, we should be investing in Social Security in a way that our elders can actually live dignified life. But that's not what the Trump administration is doing. Again, we need to be really clear when they utilize the word privatization as the most efficient way of operating. This isn't a business. These are people's lives. And we cannot afford to have these billionaires play with people's lives. This is what's happening. This is where they want us to go. This is what they want us to normalize. And it will only happen if we let it. We need to build an independent movement of working class people with the political clarity that understands, again, that Trump is a morbid symptom, that the real issue is the economic and political system of this country, and that's called capitalism. We need to build a movement that understands that this is not about reforms, that the scale of the problems that we are experiencing is too large of a scale to simply reform. We have earned reforms. We should expand those reforms. This is an issue of reorganizing society. This is an issue of working class people fighting for economic and political power. Nothing less will do. Nothing less will do. We need to make sure that we're really clear about our fate in relationship to the fate of international working class. Because right now, in the shift that is happening, where the world, that world that we knew is dying, and the new world is attempting to be born, is struggling to be born, we need midwives. We need people who have the ability to foster, to nurture, to bring that new world into existence. And that new world into existence cannot be a reform world of capitalists. There are no good capitalists. Anyone who's a millionaire or a billionaire has exploited someone at some point in their lives. There's been a level of exploitation. The biggest theft in this country is called wage theft. We need a society that abolishes, that makes it illegal for wage theft to happen. We need a society that understands that there's over 130 million people who are moving across the world. Migrants who are moving because of climate catastrophe, who are moving because of war, who are moving because of economic sanctions and blockades that the United States has played a part of. We need a society and a country and a governance that has the ability to collaborate, to build solidarity, to learn from other countries. Our ability to produce research and produce technology has declined. We are being left behind in a world that is evolving without us. And we have to fight for a new world in which we can be in collaboration with those that are growing, be in collaboration with those that are advancing, those who are bringing their people out of poverty. The United States speaks about democracy. I had someone ask me yesterday in an interview, are you a socialist that is advocating for democracy? And I thought that was an interesting question, because socialism is inherently democratic. Socialism is inherently democratic. What is undemocratic inherently is capitalism. Capitalism tells us, the system in which we live tells us, you can vote every 4 years. You can vote every 2 years. And that's good. That's the democratic right that you do. But at the end of the day, we don't have the constitutional right to health care free. We don't have the constitutional right for free education. We don't have a constitutional right for affordable and quality housing. We don't have the most basic things as a constitutional right. That is not democracy. How many of you voted Elon Musk in? How many of you know who the folks that are running our economy in the federal bank are? Nobody chose them to be in the positions they are, but they regulate the economy. They get to choose how many people are unemployed or not on any given year. Like, these are the folks that do those calculations. And the population of the United States does not know who they are. And if we do, we have no way of reaching them and complaining. That is not democracy. And so when this person asked a question, it was really interesting, because our concept of democracy is something that we need to revise and reformulate as well. Democracy needs to have the people's interest at heart. If it does not have that, then it's not democracy. If it doesn't have that, we should get the word democracy out of our vocabulary. We have been living in an economic dictatorship of billionaires. That's where we live. That's the reality. And we are moving towards a political dictatorship. That is where we're headed. A lot of people say fascism. We're not living in a fascist society yet. Capitalism inherently has fascistic elements, but it's not a fascist society. If it were, we wouldn't be able to meet here as we are. If it were, there wouldn't be any unions. They would already be slashed. If it were, there wouldn't be the possibility of student organizing. All of these things would have been already. Are there elements in capitalism? Yeah, there's fascistic elements in capitalism. It actually allows for capitalism to be born. Yes, it does. If we think about the ways in which, you know, cops came to be, for example, from slave catchers to police departments to the criminal justice system that we have, to the hyper-surveillance that we experience with our nice little smartphones and our TVs and our Alexas and all of that. That hyper-surveillance that we exist under is part of fascistic elements. But we don't live under fascism, and that's a good thing. And that's a hopeful thing. And so we also have to deconstruct that narrative that is going around that we are living in this moment, because that also disencourages people from becoming activated. What we need more than ever today is people to become activated, to break isolation, to become encouraged, emboldened, not to allow fear to strike our hearts. The emotion could be there and it's valid, but it cannot paralyze us. The moment it paralyzes us, that's when we lose. There's many things that we must do. And I'm going to close with these things. I think our movements, our people, have many tasks that not one organization can take on by itself. We need many organizations to take it on in many different fronts. We need to build cross-sectoral coalitions. We need to build coalitions and unusual alliances. We need to talk to people that we thought we'd have never talked to. We need to make a difference, differentiation between the institution of the Republican Party, the institution of the Democratic Party, and the base, the people. People who are suffering as well. People who were promised a lot of things and are not going to get it. People who are disenchanted about what is happening right now. We need to organize that discontent. We need to organize that disenchantment, that dissolution, into a powerful movement in this country, a revolutionary movement. And it's possible. Now more than ever, it is possible to do. So cross-sectoral coalition, unusual alliances. So if you don't talk to people just because they're liberal, you don't talk to people just because they're socialist, you're about to talk to each other. Because everybody's in this burning house together. We need to get the hell out. The second aspect is maintaining an internationalist idea and internationalist practice. That is very important. What Trump is doing, sending undocumented and documented people to El Salvador, is not just out of the blue. This is the exporting of a model of mass incarceration, which is also a very profitable model. The same way that I'm speaking to you about the Global South becoming a large sweatshop for the United States, they want to make the Global South the prison holder. Okay? Because if you're out of sight, you're out of mind. We're not doing it anymore. We're exporting it to El Salvador. We're exporting it to Haiti. We're exporting it to, we're not doing it anymore. We're not, they're doing it. And billionaires here are making profit out of it. And oligarchs over there are making profit out of it while persecuting and jailing people that are not criminals, that are not delinquents. So maintaining an internationalist perspective, worldview, understanding that war looks different, that it's not only boots underground, that it's economic sanctions and blockade, that when we talk about Cuban migrants coming here, we're talking about the result of 60 plus years of a blockade on Cuba that has stolen $15 million a day from the Cuban economy, that is strangling the people of Cuba. It's not the revolutionary Cuban government that is doing that. It's the United States of America. that when they talk about Venezuela and Venezuelan gang members, which is also created here because that gang that they talk so much about was not created in Venezuela. That's not the way people live in Venezuela. I've been there. I've been amongst the people of Venezuela. That the sanctions on Venezuela for the last 20 plus years is an attempt to strangle the economy and create civil war in that country. And the migrants that are coming here are a result of that strangling of the economy. And that's the United States doing that, not the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela. We have to be really, really clear that they want to be able to go to Mexico and make Mexico their backyard again. But thankfully, we have Claudia Sheinbaum there who has dignity. They can't break that dignity. They've been developing their process through Morena for decades. It wasn't only AMLO and Claudia. It's the people of Mexico that are refusing to bend their knee to imperialism. And we have a lot to learn from that. We have a lot to learn from Burkina Faso as a people. We have a lot to learn from people who refuse to bend their knee. So we need to look to the global south because they too have experienced oppression, exploitation, and a lot of them have overcome and have maintained their dignity intact. So we have cross-sectoral organizing. We have internationalism. We need to do more political education that is intentional, that has political objectives, that allow our people to learn the things that we are talking about here and probably things you talk about in your household. And political education looks different. It could be sharing, you know, a radio or a radio interview and speaking with people about it. It could be sharing an article. It could be reading a book together. It could be watching a movie together. It could be exposing people to mass mobilization. Which brings me to the fourth one. We cannot abandon the streets. We cannot abandon protest. We must take the streets. We must move people to mobilize. And we must demand that the right to protest is a right that we all should have. The moment we lose the right to dissent, it's going to become hard. I'm not going to say impossible. It's going to become hard to dissent. And so mass mobilizations alone do not change society, but they could transform a human being. They could transform a person that goes into their mass mobilization and feels the energy of many people coming together and they say, I'm not crazy. Everybody here feels like I feel, thinks like I think. I want to join an organization, which brings me to my last point. We need to build organization. We need to build organization. If we're workers and we are not unionized, we need to build a union. If we're students and there aren't any, you know, leftist progressive organizations in our campus, we need to build them. If we're in a community and there's not a lot of community organizing happening, we need to build collectives and hubs of organizing in our community to protect and defend our people. We need to do that. Because we can demand from the state to give us everything we so rightfully deserve. And they might give us the reform, but actually implementing those laws takes people power to force them to do it. And if we haven't built the organizations to mobilize, to organize, to educate, to agitate, then we're going to miss this moment and we're going to go back decades. And we cannot afford it. This moment should allow us to become stronger for the next stage of struggle. We shouldn't leave these years of Trump as they are, thinking that somehow we're going to be stronger for the next stage. If we don't fight now, we're only going to become weaker. And we don't want to become weaker. We want to become stronger. So I want to thank you all for your patience, for allowing me to share my thoughts that are not really my thoughts. In many ways, they are part of being in a political process and a political dialogue with comrades from my party, the Party for Socialism and Liberation. I think this is a moment for us to engage in more conversations like this, but these conversations are not enough. I hope you're fired up and recommitted to do more of the work that you're doing and doing it better. Thank you.
I'm ready to go.
What radicalized you?
Radicalized me. I was born in the poorest congressional district in the United States. I was born in the South Bronx. And when you are a person that has a lot of questions and there's not enough answers, you're going to keep asking questions. And that radicalizes you. I think this moment will radicalize a lot of people. I think that what has happened with the genocide in Gaza has radicalized a whole generation because they want to know why. Why is this happening? And it was the same thing for me. Why is it that my parents work so hard, that my dad does construction work and has his hands like all broken up, his knees are all messed up, his back is all messed up, and we're poor? And why am I told that somehow poverty is the deficiency of my parents who work so hard? My mom, who's an educator, that half of her paycheck, she buys school supplies to bring to school. And I had all these questions. How is it that I'm living in a society, in a place, in a neighborhood that, like, we are the recipients and distributors of all fresh produce that comes to the New York City area, the South Bronx. We have the Marqueta, the market. You know, the workers get there 4 a.m. in the morning. They package all the stuff and they bring it to the rest of the city. But I lived in a food desert where fresh produce was hard to get and expensive. And that's a contradiction of capitalism. And so I had all these questions and my mom didn't know what to do with them because my mom was, you know, not necessarily, she was ordinary working class woman with great values. I mean, the values that I have in terms of socialist values, humanist values came from my family, came from my grandmother, from my mom, from my dad, working class people that did not necessarily have the politics or the language, but had the values and principles. And that made it easier for me to become a socialist. The questioning, the values, the principles, the commitment to transform society led me to a community of people that were revolutionaries. And it's funny because they were in a faith community. So you had all these revolutionaries, leftists, socialists hiding out in a church in the 90s. And these were folks that came from El Salvador, folks that came to build solidarity work with Cuba, folks that were building the Bolivarian Revolution solidarity circles in the 90s, folks that were exiles from Chile, folks that were exiles from Nicaragua, from the, you know. So it's like, there, I was surrounded by ex-Black Panthers and ex-Young Lords at the age of 13. And they put the language together with everything that I was feeling. And then I went to Cuba at 17 and I said, I'm a socialist. They don't got to pay for healthcare. They don't got to pay for education. And imagine this, the United States is wealthier than Cuba. What can we actually do with all that wealth for the people? And a very amazing revolutionary reverend called Reverend Raul Suarez, who was the founder of the Martin Luther King Center in Cuba, said to me, I know you love in Cuba, but you can't just stay in Cuba. You got to go build your revolution in the United States and then you could come back. then you could come back. And so, you know, I was radicalized because of people who invested in me and because of my material conditions. Thank you.
You were just listening to Claudia de la Cruz, Imagining a New World. She spoke in May 2025 at KGNU in Boulder as part of her Fighting the Billionaire Coup, We Won't Back Down tour. Claudia de la Cruz is an educator and community organizer. In 2024, she ran for President of the United States, representing the Party of Socialism and Liberation. She's the executive director of IFCO, the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organization. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Claudia de la Cruz, Imagining a New World, and for Vijay Prashad's classic book, Washington Bullets, CIA Coups and Assassinations, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. MP3s and PDFs are free of charge. To get them, just call us 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Hep Ingham and KGNU. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Steve Earle. The revolution starts now.
Now, at the time, of course, that coup seemed like a complete success. At relatively low cost, the United States had overthrown a government that it didn't like and brought back the Shah, who was obviously now prepared to do America's bidding. It was a perfect success, or so it seemed at the time. It is only now, from the perspective of 50 years, that we are able to look back and see the horrific long-term consequences that this apparent success actually produced for us.
That's Stephen Kinzer, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Stephen Kinzer on Iran, the 1953 American coup, and the end of democracy. Regime change started decades ago. The new term is just a change of clothes. Dwight Eisenhower was president when the United States overthrew the popular democratic government of Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran in 1953. What was Mossadegh's transgression? He wanted Iran's oil to benefit the Iranian people. The coup brought the Shah back from exile and put him on the peacock throne. What ensued was 25 years of tyranny and repression, culminating in Ayatollah Khomeini's Islamic Revolution. The coup in Iran was one of the pivotal events of the 20th century. Virtually all Iranians know about it, yet most Americans haven't even heard of it. The U.S. professes that it supports democracy in the Middle East, yet when there was a democratic government in Iran, the U.S. destroyed it. Here to tell the story of those events is Stephen Kinzer. He's a veteran New York Times correspondent. He's co-author of Bitter Fruit and author of Crescent and Star. His latest book, A Times Notable Book of the Year, is on the 1953 coup in Iran and is called All the Shah's Men. Stephen Kinzer spoke at the Pacifica Asia Museum in Pasadena, California, in mid-September 2003.
It was August 19th, 1953. The CIA overthrew a government for the first time. It's hard for us to imagine knowing what we know about regime change and covert action in the CIA.
Before we get started,